Welcome back to the Deep Dive. This is where we take these really fascinating, sometimes kind of conflicting sources, and we dig in. We don't just skim the surface. We really try to pull out the core knowledge, the stuff you actually need to understand what's going on, and crucially, why it should matter to you. Okay, let's unpack this one. Today, we are stepping into some pretty murky water. It's this strange space where, like, true crime bumps right up against urban legend. We're talking about Humongous. A name that sounds almost like a joke, right? But the story attached, it's something else. He's this figure caught between maybe historical fact and just pure tall tale. And then there's the prison built for him, a prison that literally sank and then came back.
Yeah, and our job today, our mission, if you like, is really critical. We have to sort through this material carefully. We need to look at it through two different lenses, really. Think of it as the mythologist view that looks at the story itself. The bizarre twists, the impossible details, the things make it stick in your head, you know, the folklore. And then there's the methodologist. That's the side trying to pin down the facts. What dates can we verify? What locations are real? Because the big challenge here is separating the campfire criminal, the exaggerated boogeyman, from the most dangerous man alive that the actual records, however patchy, seem to point towards. We're kind of digging into how an institutional ghost story gets made.
It really demands that kind of split approach, doesn't it? Because the pieces themselves are just so out there. You've got these alleged crimes back in the 30s, then this absolutely wild 1934 escape flushing himself down a toilet. I mean, come on. But then, the recapture, 67 days later, he apparently tries to get a job.
At the same prison.
At the exact same prison he just broke out of.
Yeah.
Then he gets shipped off to this secret, super remote island prison, Filligan's Island, and then that place gets hit by a tsunami in 49. Just gone, swallowed by the sea.
Only for it to reappear 5 years later.
Leaving behind this incredibly creepy question mark right in the deepest part of the prison. It feels like a story designed to make you question everything. Control, nature, crime.
Okay, let's start with the man himself. Humongous. Even the name feels a bit off-kilter. And the very first description you find in some of these sources, it hits you immediately. It sets this weird, paradoxical tone for everything that follows. I have to quote this directly because it's such a perfect hook. This was the most dangerous man to ever step on Earth, and he was kind of cute. Right. That contrast is everything. It's the engine driving this whole legend. It tells you straight away, this isn't your typical monster. No scars, no obvious evil radiating off him. He's approachable, maybe even charming, kind of cute.
Oh.
And that makes the most dangerous man on Earth part so much more unsettling. If you look like a monster, the story is simple. Capture the monster, contain the monster, done. But when the danger looks ordinary, even pleasant, well, that suggests the threat isn't obvious. It's hidden. It's maybe inside him in a way you can't see. It's the ultimate wolf in sheep's clothing, right? But dialed up to an insane level.
And the crimes attributed to him back in the 1930s, they definitely lean into that idea of like an internal, almost unnatural kind of menace. It's not just the sheer number of victims, which is staggering, but the how. That's what really pushes him into myth territory, isn't it?
Absolutely. So the records or the legends derived from them suggest he was arrested for killing over 200 people. Just pause on that number, 200. That alone puts him in a category that few, if any, criminals occupied at the time. It's almost industrial scale. But then you get to the method, and this is where, you know, the methodologist in us just goes, wait, what? Well, the mythologist says, oh, tell me more. The sources claim he did it with just his thumb.
With his thumb. Okay. That just, it sounds physically impossible. Even if you imagine incredible strength or maybe some kind of lost anatomical knowledge, pressure point, something. 200 people with a thumb. It feels like it has to be an invention, an exaggeration.
And maybe it is, but that's the point, isn't it? From a folklore perspective, that specific, almost absurd detail with his thumb, that's what lifts Humongous out of the ordinary, even the ordinary world of horrific true crime. It makes him something else. Think about it psychologically. A killer with a gun or a knife, you can take the weapon away. You can understand the mechanism. But a thumb, that part of him, it's innate. The story is basically saying the danger is him. His very physical being is the weapon. It implies this unique, almost superhuman capacity for violence.
But couldn't that backfire? Doesn't relying on something so impossible like the thumb thing just make it easier to dismiss the whole story? Wouldn't the methodologist just say, okay, this is clearly exaggerated fear talking?
Well, yes and no. The methodologist might dismiss the literal thumb killings, sure. It strains credulity past the breaking point. But they can't easily discuss the impact of that claim. Why did this story arise? Why was he considered so dangerous? The number 200 suggests something terrifying happened or was believed to have happened. The mythologist steps in and says, the thumb detail is the explanation for that terror. It provides the narrative justification for the extreme reaction he provoked. It makes him not just a mass murderer, but something elemental, a force. And it's memorable, isn't it? The simple tool, the thumb, versus the unbelievable scale of the crime. That contrast is why we're talking about Humongous today, and maybe not some other criminal from the 30s whose name faded. It justifies what comes next.
Right, so if you're the authorities back then, and you're faced with a guy accused of that, killing 200 people with just a thumb, you can't just put him in a regular cell, you can't treat him normally.
Exactly.
He becomes this anomaly, something that breaks all the existing protocols.
The sheer impossibility of the alleged crime almost forces an equally extreme response from the state. They have to escalate their methods to match the perceived threat, the scale of the myth they're dealing with. And that perception, that need to treat him as something beyond human, that sets up the next chapter perfectly, the 1934 escape, which is just, well, it's absurd.
Utterly absurd. Rough. If we treat this part as folklore, the mechanics are almost comical in how degrading they are. He doesn't dig a tunnel with a spoon over months. He doesn't scale a wall. Nope. He apparently flushed himself down a prison toilet.
Yeah.
And then the sources say he crawled for miles through the sewer system. Miles.
I mean, just picture that. It's this ultimate descent, physically and, you'd imagine, psychologically. It's like the hero's journey, but inverted. He's going down into the filth, the hidden underbelly of the system. It shows incredible determination, obviously. But also, this willingness to embrace absolute degradation for freedom. The prison contained his body above ground, but the plumbing. That was the weak point they missed.
You can almost imagine the panic in the prison when they realized, where is he? Check the walls. No, sir. Check the U-bend.
The sheer embarrassment for the prison officials must have been immense.
Oh, absolutely. Humiliation all around. But the real narrative kicker, the thing that makes the story truly unforgettable, isn't just the escape. It's the recapture. 67 days later. Think about that. He's out. He's free for over 2 months, having gone through hell to get there. And where do they find him?
Trying to get a job.
Yeah. At the exact same prison he'd just escaped from.
67 days. He endures the sewers, gets out, survives somehow, and his big plan is to walk back in and ask for work. It's just, it's either insane hubris or some kind of profound psychological break, right? Like, a novelist would probably cut that scene for being too unbelievable. How do you even begin to analyze that?
Uh-huh.
That's the challenge for the methodologist, isn't it? Because it defies rational behavior so completely. You have to consider these wild possibilities. Was he that confident he wouldn't be recognized? Just pure blinding arrogance. Or was it delusion? Did the experience of the escape, the sewers, the time outside, did it somehow warp his thinking? Did he lose touch with reality? Or, and this is maybe the most disturbing thought, was he deliberately trying to get caught? Do you want to go back?
So the escape wasn't really about achieving lasting freedom. Maybe it was about the act of escaping itself. The journey?
That's a key question. Did that whole ordeal fundamentally change him? His goals? His understanding of where he belonged? Walking back in, presumably with some kind of application? It suggests either he thought he was invisible, or maybe... maybe freedom wasn't the goal anymore. Mm-hmm. Perhaps the only place he felt truly seen, truly acknowledged for the unique threat he supposedly represented was inside that prison.
It really does echo that weird real-life Mario idea we talked about before from the Inspector Story series. The guy going down into the literal sewers looking for his boss fight.
Exactly. That parallel is strong here. Remember the line, like Mario, chasing the castle changes the player first. The environment Mungus chose the sewer system. It's the ultimate other space. It's foul, dangerous, unseen. It disconnects you from the normal world. Spending time down there, surviving that, maybe it did change him. Maybe he realized that the normal world outside couldn't contain him, couldn't understand him. Perhaps only the prison, the institution built because of him, was the right scale for his existence. His return wasn't a blunder. Maybe it was like gravity, pulling him back to the only place that could define him. Maybe confinement wasn't his punishment. It was his stage, his identity.
Wow. So the prison authorities suddenly weren't just dealing with an escapee. They were dealing with someone who broke out only to realize he couldn't or maybe didn't want to stay out. They must have realized they needed something completely different, a containment solution that went way beyond standard prison design.
Precisely. That realization that maybe Mungus needed the prison in some twisted way that seems to have pushed them towards the next drastic step. After the toilet escape, after the mind-bending job application recapture, they knew they needed more than just high walls. They needed impossibility. They needed a place designed to erase him from the world. Enter Filligan's Island Penitentiary.
Felgen's Island. It sounds purpose-built for a legend, doesn't it? Like something out of a dark comic book. This feels like the state matching the myth with its own mythic response.
That seems to be exactly the idea. Felgen's was presented as the final answer, the ultimate secure facility. Location was key. Ultra-remote. Hundreds and hundreds of miles from anywhere. From civilization, from shipping lanes, from help. It was designed to make escape totally pointless. Even if you somehow got outside the walls, where could you possibly go? You'd just die in the wilderness or the ocean. It was containment through sheer, overwhelming geography.
So not just a fortress to keep him in, but a location designed to make him disappear entirely from human concern. An institutional black hole. Built on the idea that humans could conquer geography, could carve out a space immune to failure.
And Hugh Mungus, the catalyst for all this, he got special treatment even within this fortress of isolation. He wasn't just on the island, he was kept in the basement, the deepest, most isolated part of the prison. And the reasoning given in the sources is really telling. It wasn't just about preventing his escape. They put him down there because they were afraid for the safety of the other prisoners.
Whoa, hang on, let that sink in. The other prisoners, murderers, hardened criminals, the worst society had locked up point. They needed protection from Hugh Mungus.
That's what the narrative suggests. It cements his status as uniquely dangerous. More dangerous to fellow inmates than they were to the outside world. So they put him at the very bottom, the absolute lowest point of the most remote prison ever built. It's like institutional fear made concrete. Literally.
But that very isolation, that extreme measure, it sets up this perfect, almost Greek tragedy kind of conflict, doesn't it? The ultimate human-made structure designed to contain the supposedly uncontrollable human element ends up being completely vulnerable to uncontrollable natural forces.
Exactly. The hubris of the builders met the indifference of the planet. And that confrontation came in 1949. Nature, you could say, delivered its verdict on Felgen's Island.
A massive tsunami. And we're not talking just flooding here. The sources are clear. The entire island, the whole prison complex, foundations and all, was just buried. Gone. Underneath the ocean. A complete catastrophic erasure.
It's the perfect brutal climax to that phase of the story. The ultimate symbol of human control is just wiped off the map by a wave. The man who beat the plumbing couldn't beat the Pacific Ocean, presumably. Nature provides the final prison, the ultimate lockdown. The system failed to hold him, maybe, but the planet itself succeeded, or so it seemed at the time.
Right, because this is where the story pivots again. It stops being just a disaster story and turns into something, well, much weirder, almost supernatural. 5 years pass, 5 years with Felgen's Island presumably sitting on the seabed, and then it reemerges. Now, okay, the methodologist in me is screaming about geology here. How does a whole sunken prison complex just pop back up enough for people to get inside?
Yeah, the geological mechanics are, let's say, highly improbable without some other massive event. But the mythologist doesn't care about tectonic plates. The mythologist needs the story to continue. The sea has to give the prison back, even if it means bending the rules of reality a bit. The stage needs to be reset for the final act.
Okay, suspending disbelief on the geology for a moment. Investigators finally get back inside this waterlogged, half-ruined prison. What do they find?
Well, initially it seems pretty straightforward. Tragically so. They find the remains of the general population, the guards, the other prisoners, the ones not deemed dangerous enough for the basement isolation. Their remains are there. It confirms the tsunami was devastatingly lethal to everyone on the upper levels, a complete wipeout of the staff and the standard inmates.
So, a grim discovery, but conclusive. Everyone who was supposed to be in the main part of the prison is accounted for. Tragic, but the books are closed on them.
Exactly. Everyone accounted for.
Yeah.
Except one. Except the reason the prison existed in the first place. And this brings us to the absolute core of the enduring mystery. The basement cell. When the investigators finally made their way down there, to that deepest, most secure cell, the one built just for Mungus, the tone of the sources changes. It becomes less about finding bodies and more about a feeling. A sudden, chilling realization.
Yeah, the specific phrase used is incredibly potent. It says that upon reaching Hugh Mungus's cell, the investigators would quickly realize they were not as safe as they once thought.
Think about that phrasing. It's not the cell was empty. It's not they found evidence of a struggle. It's about their feeling, their sudden sense of danger, in a place that should be, by all rights, completely inert. A flooded 5-year-old tomb. Why would they suddenly feel unsafe?
Okay, playing devil's advocate again. Maybe that's just poetic license. Maybe the cell was empty, meaning he likely died in the tsunami, but his body was washed away, lost to the sea. And the not feeling safe is just dramatic flair, covering up the fact that they couldn't account for their prize prisoner, dead or alive. It's an admission of failure, maybe.
That's the rational take, certainly. The methodologist would lean towards body lost at sea, case technically unresolved but likely deceased.
Hmm.
But the methodologist hears that phrase, not as safe as they once thought, and sees something else entirely. It keeps the threat alive. It suggests possibilities far more frightening than just finding remains. One, the cell was empty. He somehow survived the tsunami that killed everyone else. He got out. Where is he? Two, maybe the cell wasn't quite empty. Maybe there was evidence of something else, something that suggested his impossible strength, his thumb power, had manifested even against the crushing water, leaving a residue of violence. Or three, perhaps the most chilling. The cell was empty, but the sheer legend of the man, the psychic weight of his supposed evil, had somehow saturated the space, that the absence itself felt dangerous.
So the empty cell becomes the symbol of ultimate institutional failure. They built the world's most secure prison, put him in the most secure part of it, nature destroys the prison, and 5 years later, the only record left of their most dangerous inmate is nothing. Just a lingering sense of dread.
Precisely. The tsunami wiped out the prison, and likely any paper records along with it. All that's left is the folklore, amplified by the very emptiness of that cell. The legend outlives the evidence. And that's why the investigators felt unsafe, because if the prison and a tsunami couldn't definitively account for him, then the containment failed. Utterly. The threat wasn't neutralized, it was potentially unleashed, or at least its fate was terrifyingly unknown. The cell offers no closure, only the confirmation that the myth might still be real.
The institution was supposed to provide the final answer, contained, deceased. But it didn't. It contained everyone else, but not the one who mattered most to the legend. The ambiguity is the scary part. It's what allows the story to keep going.
And that brings us right to the heart of it, doesn't it? Synthesizing these two views, Humongous, the story, exists perfectly in that gap between the methodologist wanting hard facts and the mythologist needing a powerful narrative. His tale is just a textbook example of how fear gets encoded and passed down. So the mythologist view, it's almost perfectly engineered for survival as folklore. You start with impossible survival, the sewer escape. You pivot to this bizarre, darkly funny irony, the job application. Then you hit them with cosmic horror, the tsunami, the sunken prison, and cap it off with an enduring, spooky mystery, the empty cell that feels dangerous. Those beats, especially layered onto the thumb killer origin, they guarantee the story gets told and retold, because it feels significant, even if it defies logic. The legend needs him to be more than just a man.
Right. And then the methodologist view is just pure frustration, really. You have these anchors in time. 1934, the escape. That was likely reported, documented somewhere. 1949, the tsunami. That's a potentially verifiable event, maybe through geological records, old news reports, maritime logs, something.
Sure. Those dates give it a grounding in reality.
But the crucial piece, the proof, the resolution, it's missing. The empty basement cell completely defeats the methodologist. Where there should be a final entry in the record subject deceased or remains recovered, there's just this feeling, this reported sense of unease from the investigators.
The institution failed. Its records were destroyed or are incomplete at the most critical point.
Which means the legend wins, in a way. The sea destroyed the prison, destroyed the proof, but it kind of supercharged the myth by leaving that question unanswered.
Exactly. Nature swaddled the physical evidence, but in doing so, it preserved the folklore. It left only the possibility space for the myth to inhabit.
So let's tie together those three core themes we pulled out. First, the tall tale criminal folklore. That's the thumb killer part, the sheer scale, the reason for the extreme reaction. Second, institutions swallowed by nature. Finnegan's Island is the ultimate example. Human control, human certainty, just obliterated by the environment, shows our limits. And third, maybe the most important takeaway for anyone listening, the danger of legends outliving records. The legend gives you a story, something concrete, even if it's unbelievable. But the actual record, the empty cell, that reported feeling of danger, it only confirms that we don't know.
And that uncertainty is key. The methodologist wants proof of death to close the file. The mythologist thrives on the lack of proof, because it means he could still be out there.
It's like the human brain can handle a tragedy, even a massive one, like the deaths of the other prisoners and guards. It's definite. Sad, but definite. But an indefinite threat. A potentially unkillable boogeyman who survived being at the bottom of the ocean for 5 years, that's much harder to process.
That's why the empty cell is so potent. It implies Mungus was different, special, dangerous enough, or maybe just strange enough, to survive what killed everyone else.
Yeah.
It suggests he might now be changed, altered by that experience,
yeah,
and free. The story really drives home that sometimes not having an answer is far, far scarier than getting bad news.
If they'd found bones, he'd be a historical footnote, a grisly one, but contained by the past. Because they found nothing. Or rather, they found an absence that felt dangerous. The fear remains present tense. He could still be walking around. Defined by impossible crimes and an impossible survival. Hashtag outro. So, what a journey we've taken today, right from a prison toilet in the 1930s, through miles of muck into an employment office at the very prison he fled, and finally down into the waterlogged basement of Filligan's Island, the prison that sank and came back. We've grappled with these incredibly specific, almost dreamlike details. 200 kills with a thumb, 67 days of freedom ending in a job application, and that unbelievable image of the tsunami swallowing an entire island prison in 1949. Where does this leave us? What's the takeaway here? Who or what should we really find more frightening? Is it the man who could supposedly kill 200 people with such brutal, intimate simplicity? Or is it the man whose existence is now verified only by folklore and by an empty, chilling cell deep beneath the waves, a cell that whispered danger even after 5 years underwater? Leaving this constant, nagging fear that he defied not just walls, but the ocean itself.
You know, the whole strange, unsettling history really boils down to one final provocative thought. It comes directly from the source material, summing up the failure, the mystery. The failure of Filligan's Island gives us the only real truth we have left. The sea gave the prison back, but not the answer to who walked out.
Wow, okay. So here's something to really mull over. If the official records were washed away, if the land itself shifted and obscured the scene, what single piece of evidence could possibly surface now? What could ever truly prove how Hugh Mungus lived, or more importantly, perhaps, prove how or even if he died? It's a hell of a question. And a perfect place where history just dissolves into the fog of enduring, terrifying folklore.